Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the victory laps by both the Republican right and the Russiagate skeptic left, celebrating what is widely reported as an exoneration of President Trump by the Mueller report, even though the report has not seen the light of day, and all we know about it is from a four-page summary written by an attorney general who was chosen because he did not believe a president can be indicted or charged with obstruction of justice, who was able to put his own spin on the much-anticipated report to shape public perceptions. Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent for The Week, where he has an article, Ignore the Media's Trump-Russia Recriminations, Look at the Big Picture Instead, joins us to discuss these strange bedfellows celebrating an exoneration that did not happen either for Trump or Russia, since even in Barr's letter it is made clear that Mueller found the Russians were engaged in two main efforts to influence the 2016 election in Trump's favor. We'll also look into how Trump is now going on the offensive, answering the call to investigate the investigators. And while some Democrats appear to be on the defensive, given that the fix was in, the need for the whole Mueller report to be released to the public as soon as possible could not be more urgent and necessary, so that the American people can see for themselves what Mueller and his investigators found. Then, with the Trump administration asking a federal appeals court to rule the entire Affordable Care Act unconstitutional, we'll assess whether the courts could do what the Republican Congress failed to do time and time again, and speak with Dania Palenka, a research professor at the Center on Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown's Health Policy Institute, where she analyzes state and federal health insurance market reforms, including implementation of the Affordable Care Act. We'll examine whether Trump's move could backfire and become the campaign issue in 2020. Then finally, Manuel Castells, the world-renowned sociologist, joins us in the studio. He is the university professor and the Wallace Annenberg Chair of Communication Technology and Society at the University of Southern California and the author of the new book, Rupture, The Crisis of Liberal Democracy. We will discuss the crisis in legitimacy roiling the global political landscape with the election of Trump, Brexit, the demise of traditional political parties, the rise of the extreme right, and the nationalist challenge threatening the European Union as worldwide kleptocratic and authoritarian regimes seek to undermine democratic governments and institutions. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And he's the co-host of At Left Anchor podcast. And his latest article at The Week is Ignore the Media's Trump-Russia Recriminations, Look at the Big Picture Instead. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Ryan. And as you point out, both the Republican right and the Russiagate skeptic left are taking victory laps with Trump tweeting out total exoneration. Then, of course, you've got Matt Taibbi writing in Rolling Stone that it's official. Russiagate is this generation's weapons of mass destruction. All this based upon a four-page letter by a pretty clearly partisan attorney general who was chosen because he didn't believe the president could be indicted or charged with obstruction of justice. And he's been able to put his personal spin on what the report says. And God knows when we're going to see this report after it's been redacted for classified information and grand jury information. So that's what I find extraordinary, is that everybody is getting all exercised over a four-page summary that may or may not reflect what Mueller's report's about.
Yeah, and also it's worth noting that Barr was previously most famous for basically covering up the Iran-Contra scandal. That was his previous sort of resume entry before he, you know, submitted that letter that got him the attorney general job, you know. So like, it's not a source that you would you would sort of say, like, this is the most neutral, credible person to summarize this thing. And yeah, as you say, you know, the kind of the victory laps from the Trump and the anti-Trump factions are extremely premature.
Well, at least in the four-page summary, I'll just read a couple of small passages. The special counsel's investigation determined that there was two main Russian efforts to influence the 2016 election. The first involved attempts by a Russian organization, the Internet Research Agency, to conduct disinformation and social media operations in the United States designed to sow social discord, eventually with the aim of interfering with the election. The second element involved the Russian government's efforts to conduct computer hacking operations designed to gather and disseminate information to influence the election. The special counsel found that Russian government actors successfully hacked into computers and obtained emails from persons affiliated with the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party organizations and publicly disseminated those materials through various intermediaries, including WikiLeaks. Based on these activities, the special counsel brought criminal charges against a number of Russian military officers for conspiring to hack into computers in the United States for purposes of influencing the election. Now, doesn't that mean that... there was some involvement. Why this sort of blindness about, I mean, it's true that it was being overhyped for the last 2 years and that there are some people out there like Louise Mensch, who, by the way, has always, as far as I know, been on Rupert Murdoch's payroll and helped him skate when she was a Conservative member of the parliamentary inquiry into the despicable behaviour of News Corp in the United Kingdom. But I'm just astounded that somehow... nothing that we've been looking at for the last couple of years is being recognized as being real.
Yeah, this is the really sort of head-spinning kind of propaganda narrative that we're seeing in this first few days, which is, you know, these few people, the Trump right, and a handful of sort of people who have sort of trolled themselves into becoming apologists for Trump, like Michael Tracy and even Glenn Greenwald, a guy who I respect a lot, you know, going on Tucker Carlson's white supremacist show to sort of say, you know, Trump innocent, the media screwed this up. These people who have paid more attention to Russia than even the most obsessed resistance type of people. But, I mean, this is what I was trying to do in my article, is that in the first instance, the Mueller report, as quoted in the Barr summary, did not say that they had definitively established there was no coordination or collusion between the Trump, like, operation and Russia. They said they couldn't prove it. They said they did not establish it. Not that he was completely exonerated. And in the second instance, you have this obstruction of justice issue, which I think is, like, in the Barr memo is a little bit more interesting, because in Barr's memo that he said, which concluded that the president was incapable of committing in obstruction of justice, nevertheless, as a sort of prefatory remark, said that if the president suborned perjury or tried to change the testimony of someone, that would be perjury. And we have from various news reports that the president dangled pardons, or the president's lawyers dangled pardons before Michael Flynn and before Paul Manafort, in what was almost certainly an effort to get them to not cooperate with the Mueller investigation. And Michael Cohen testified before Congress that the reason that he had perjured himself before Congress previously was that Trump had basically, he had implicitly pushed him to not talk about the Trump Tower Moscow project, to lie about when it had stopped, when in fact it continued up through like the mid-2016. And his remarks had been edited by a Trump lawyer, Jay Sekulow. So this conclusion that, you know, you're seeing from both Trump and the anti-Trump sort of left that this is sort of a vindication, I think it's just wildly premature. We have now a summary written by someone who was appointed because he believes that the president basically can't commit crimes, and who was previously known for whitewashing a massive instance of presidential lawbreaking in the executive branch broadly. And what the probe, the special counsel investigation, has already produced is indictments of over two dozen Russian nationals and Russian intelligence operatives for interfering in the election. Seven people directly associated with Trump have been convicted of, felonies or other crimes, including his campaign manager, his national security advisor, his own personal lawyer, and another one who is still on trial, Roger Stone. And it's an incredibly obvious just spin operation, you know, from various kind of like psycho-political motivations to say that Trump didn't do anything wrong. And when you look at the broader context, that from what Mueller has established, the people that he has convicted, the people who are going to prison or already in prison, and the folks who have been indicted but will never go to jail because, you know, they're in Russia, it's a compelling narrative of, number one, the Trump campaign is just infested with criminality. And number two, there actually was an attempt by Russia to influence the 2016 election. The Republican candidate, even if he did not actually like explicitly participate in that, he welcomed it on national television. He said, "Russia, please hack more of Hillary's emails. You know, I hope they find the 40,000 missing emails." And the rest of the party, from Paul Ryan to Mitch McConnell, they exercise their power to prevent bipartisan action to stop that interference effort. Mm-hmm. And so this narrative that Trump has been exonerated, it's preposterous. It's preposterous.
Well, it goes beyond that now. Of course, they're talking about, the Trumpsters are talking about investigating the investigators, and he's going to turn the tables, yeah, and feels empowered. And of course, today, the House failed to override his veto on his wall, 248-181. So he's riding high. So just in the last few minutes, Ryan, let's try and figure out then. It's pretty clear to me that the fix is in with Barr, and that was the whole reason he got there. And I think it was even more than that. I think he's actually saving the Republican brand from being really sullied by an indictment of the leader of the party, the president. So what kind of pressure can be put on him? It's all in the same guy that's put this spin out that everybody's fallen for, and he's shaped the narrative. Barr, he's also the guy that's editing the report as we speak, and he's got a lot of flexibility on what's classified and what's not, and, you know, grand jury testimony and all this stuff. So God knows what we're going to see, a pretty shredded report at best. What can the American people do, and their representatives, who are on the defensive, the Democrats, because now the Republicans are saying, now that he's been exonerated, why are you guys having all these committee inquiries?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to ask for is that we should see the whole report. And a lot of the key sections, there's really no kind of national security interest that you could sort of pin on that, you know, like obviously what Barr would want to do is just redact the entire thing and release a report that says, dear Attorney General, like black lines for 50 pages and, you know, in conclusion. So I think that they can push for that. And there are mechanisms by which, you know, you can have sort of secret hearings of closed sessions of Intelligence Committee hearings to discuss the classified portions of it. And I think in the second case is just to emphasize what is already known beyond question, because you have the various convictions of multiple Trump operatives or Republican operatives or people associated with the Republican Party, and what has been reported in the news, and just try to say, I mean, I would say in addition to trying to push a broader kind of policy agenda, just to say that, like, no, this is not an exoneration at all. You have sort of legalistically cleared Trump of the most damning accusation, but the rest of it is still incredibly damning. And what we know publicly is terrible. And the sort of social balance of opinion doesn't change that thing. And to just say that, like, what we know from Mueller is Trump is crooked, even if he didn't directly conspire with Vladimir Putin himself to say, you know, like, let's do crimes together. He embraced the efforts of a foreign government to interfere in an American election. And that, you know, is disqualifying, I would say, for a president. You know, you should not allow that sort of thing to happen.
Right.
And that, and again, as a broader context for policy, but it's like Democrats got to stop being too defensive about this. You know, they thought that Mueller would sort of hand them this like golden grenade that would destroy Trump. But, like, of course, that probably wasn't going to happen. You know, it's like the government is too corrupt for that, but it's not the end of the story.
Sure. And of course, just to finish up on the election issues of Russian interference, which continues to this day, no, the Trump has also stymied all efforts to do anything about it. So,
yeah,
you know, it's pretty amazing that you can have an electronic Pearl Harbor, and instead of retaliating, we've got this love fest going between Trump and Putin. It is surreal. Anyway, I thank you for joining us, Ryan Cooper. I hope at least we get to see something soon that resembles the Mueller report, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Okay. And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And he's the co-host of At Left Anchor podcast. And his latest article at The Week is Ignore the Media's Trump-Russia Recriminations. Look at the Big Picture Instead. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Trump administration's request to a federal appeals court to rule the entire Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Danya Palenka, who is the Assistant Research Professor at the Center on Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown's Health Policy Institute, where she analyzes state and federal health insurance market reforms, including implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And previously, she was a Senior Counsel for Health and Reproductive Rights at the National Women's Law Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Danya Palenka.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I don't know how happy you are or I am to learn today that the Trump administration is increasing or upping its ante in attacking the Affordable Care Act, telling a federal appeals court that it now believes the entire law should be invalidated. This is extraordinary. And do you think it's going to happen?
This is extraordinary. I will actually, for a one-time thing, quote Antonin Scalia from one of his dissents on one of the cases upholding the Affordable Care Act and say this is pure applesauce, in that from a legal theory standpoint, it does not make sense either for this administration to not be defending the law, but also that the entire Affordable Care Act should be thrown out. It doesn't make sense. I do not expect that in the end this will be upheld, because courts usually do find ways to sever the part of the law that is unconstitutional. So if in the end the courts do sort of continue to say that the individual mandate is unconstitutional now, I think the most likelihood is at least some of the law will be severable. But it's the courts. I'm not a judge. I'm not a Supreme Court justice. I can't be certain where it will end up. There is definitely the potential that the DOJ new interpretation will end up being what gets ruled on at the end of the day.
So would this then, if it happens, is this a case where things just have to get really bad before they get better? I mean, it's such an irony that we have this contrast to the Democrats wanting to expand Medicare and do Medicare for all, and this idea of in strengthening the Affordable Care Act. I mean, obviously, there's a whole bunch of different proposals, with Beto O'Rourke having a somewhat different approach to the most of the other candidates. But in general, the impression you get is that the Democrats want to make the Affordable Care Act work and expand it, make it more accessible to more people, and that the president wants to get rid of the one thing that seems to be working and doesn't have an alternative or a substitute. So if you look forward and assuming the courts go along with the Trump administration, what kind of a country are we going to be looking at in a few years' time?
I mean, as far as the country with health care, if the courts do agree and invalidate the entire Affordable Care Act, we are going to have a disaster in our health care system, because we will have 20 million more people uninsured. We are going to lose all the consumer protections that people have come to know from the Affordable Care Act, like coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, preventive services covered without cost sharing, and the Medicaid expansion in California, Medi-Cal expansion. But there's even more changes to our health system that were made through the Affordable Care Act that most people don't know of. The Affordable Care Act is what has been closing the Medicare donut hole, which means if the courts throw the entire law out, suddenly our seniors are going to be paying thousands of dollars more per year to get their prescription drugs covered, and many won't be able to afford their prescription drugs coverage. There are other changes to the Medicare system that are really about how, you know, hospitals are reimbursed and those types of things that are just going to go away. And yeah, the idea that, you know, suddenly the government is going to have to figure this out quickly, unless this happens after a new election that has really changed what Washington looks like. We are in a very partisan country right now, and a very bipartisan government. And, you know, we're not going to be passing, and I don't see anything passing, you know, during this current Congress and this current president that significantly reforms and provides a real replacement, because that is hard to find that agreement. And right now, as you said, the Democrats, you know, are looking at going above and beyond with the Affordable Care Act, building on the expansions. Some are talking about Medicare for all. And that is the exact opposite of where the Trump administration is, where they're saying, hey, let's just get rid of it all.
So this lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act, Texas versus the United States, was filed last year by a group of Republican governors and state attorney generals. And I think it was the lieutenant governor of Texas is close to this judge. And it looks as though it was sort of an inside job in terms of blocking Obama. Isn't that the foundation upon which the Trump administration is resting its case?
Texas picked a court that they knew would be more likely to side with them. You know, it's there's something in our legal system where people district shop. You know, they look for the court where they can file a case where it's most likely going to have their outcome. And so the states that brought this lawsuit, including Texas, clearly did that. We knew from the beginning that this judge was more likely to be deciding in their favor. And, you know, whether the administration is, you know, hopping on board of that, I'm not sure, or if they, you know, are just trying to go back to a campaign promise that they had made to repeal Obamacare, which was a campaign promise, although I can't help but note that, you know, the many of those who did try to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act in, you know, 2 years ago didn't do so well in the last elections.
So if this is indeed a campaign promise on the part of the president, and of course he seems to be adamant about keeping his campaign promises, one of the more central ones, of course, being building the wall, which he's literally almost gone up, put us into a situation of a constitutional crisis in order to get his wall. So we know he's determined in terms of fulfilling campaign promises, but there's also a tremendous animus towards Obama and undoing everything that Obama did. So I've been reading some headlines in the more, the Huffington Post and others, more kind of liberal. I hate to use the word liberal. You know, the liberal media is more of a canard than a reality. But nevertheless, there's this kind of peculiar form of wishful thinking going on that said, oh, well, Trump is just going to bring himself down by this attack on the Affordable Care Act. I know you're a specialist on the nuts and bolts, if you will, and not about the politics, but how do you see it? Do you think that this will backfire on Trump?
I think this is definitely guaranteeing that health care is going to be an issue in the next presidential election. It was going to be anyway, but this really will be bringing it more to the forefront, particularly if before the election the courts rule in favor of now the administration position and repeal the Affordable Care Act, because then you have a situation where if he is running for president at the time where our health coverage is imploding in America, people are going to be losing their coverage at the time that they vote. In that instance, I don't see how this doesn't backfire on him. If the courts uphold the Affordable Care Act, you know, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe his base is happy that he's tried to do what he promised to do, but in reality, it didn't end up making a difference. And that might be part of the decision making. It's very possible that those who made this decision think the Affordable Care Act will be upheld. And it's the whole idea of, it's always easier to vote against a law that you know is going to pass, or to vote for a law that you know is going to fail, because that way you haven't changed the outcome, but you are also still, could be in the good graces of the people who wanted something different from the outcome. So that's a potential that is out there. But as I said, if the Affordable Care Act is overturned before the end of the Trump presidency, 20 million people are going to lose coverage. We're going to have that. That's going to definitely affect his political future.
Well, I recently interviewed a physician and a psychiatrist at Vanderbilt in Tennessee, and he's written a book called Dying of Whiteness. And the book is simply about people in the South and in the Midwest who voted for Trump and voted for politicians who essentially enacting policies that are detrimental to the health of the very people who voted for them. And in this case, one of the subjects in the book is a man who's dying of hepatitis in Tennessee, and right next door in Kentucky, he would be able to get the drugs and stay alive because of Medicaid expansion. And when asked about, why does he support politicians in Tennessee who are against expanding Medicaid, he said, I don't want my tax dollars going to Mexicans. I mean, where do you see this peculiar resistance, or where is the support Trump has? Presumably he does have a lot of people. He has his base, about a third of the country. What's your understanding of why people essentially are against health care, even though it could save their lives?
I think people are for health care. I think it was very clear, both in the last election, but also from polling, people support access to health care. People support protections for people with pre-existing conditions. I think the disconnect is between what people support and what the politicians they vote for support. And that sometimes, the information that gets to all voters is often not clear. It's sometimes misleading. And people don't necessarily understand that they might be voting for a candidate that is looking to take away their health care or to not expand health care that they have access to, because that candidate is out there saying, I protect pre-existing conditions. Just earlier today, Trump tweeted out that the Republican Party will be the party of health care. I don't know what that means, but I think it's intended to mean that he and the Republican Party are going to strengthen and expand health care. If that's the message someone hears, then they are hearing a message that these are the people to vote to expand health care. And they may not really ever get the understanding of what the true policy distinctions really mean between the parties or between politicians.
Well, then it's incumbent upon the Democrats to come up with a counter-narrative that makes more sense. I mean, one of the strange things about the Affordable Care Act and the launch of the Affordable Care Act was that it sort of succeeded in spite of the lackluster way in which it was promoted.
Yeah, I think one of the most important outcomes of the effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act is that people learned what the Affordable Care Act does, and people learned what Medicaid does. It's tremendous how the efforts to not just take away the Affordable Care Act, but to cut Medicaid that were brought into that really brought out such a strong campaign by people who depend on Medicaid. And it really increased the understanding in America, I think, of what Medicaid is, and that it's a program that provides health care to children and adults with disabilities, that it provides a true safety net for people who, have unexpected changes in their situation. And suddenly, people also started to learn that their neighbors are on Medicaid, which they may not have realized, and how important it really is. And I think politicians can and have been building off of that moving forward, and that's really where the messaging has really been coming out of now. I think we are in a very different place because of repeal and replace. And when people suddenly saw what they were at risk of losing, that's very different than when the Affordable Care Act first got implemented and people were trying to learn about a new law that was going to be in place in a few years, or even as it first got into place, people didn't always know that they were enrolled in Obamacare. Kentucky's actually a great example. When they at first, had Kentucky in their name, and the other states did the same thing, so that it wasn't Obamacare they were enrolling in. It was it was a health plan with that state's name, even covered California is the exchange in California.
Well, just in the last minute then, Danya Palenka, give us your assessment on the odds. If I know not necessarily, you may not be a betting person, but what do you think the odds are that the courts will go along with the Trump administration and rule the entire Affordable Care Act unconstitutional? Will they just sever that one part of the individual mandate?
I remain cautiously optimistic that most, if not all, of the Affordable Care Act will be upheld, because even if the individual mandate is unconstitutional, just going on how our court system works, all of the law that can be severed should be, and there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't sever the Medicaid expansion, the donut hole, and even, menu labeling from the rest of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, Danya Palenka, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Danya Palenka, who is an assistant research professor at the Center on Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown's Health Policy Institute, where she analyzes state and federal health insurance market reforms, including implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And previously, she was a senior counsel for health and reproductive rights at the National Women's Law Center. We're going to take a brief station break and joined in the studio by the world-renowned sociologist Manuel Castells, discussing the crisis of legitimacy roiling the global political landscape.
You may be surprised, people in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Manuel Castells, University Professor in the Wallace Annenberg Chair of Communication Technology and Society at the University of Southern California, as well as a Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and a fellow at St. John's College, Cambridge. And his latest book just out is Rupture, The Crisis of Liberal Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank you.
Manuel Castells. So the crisis of liberal democracy is pretty evident, and it's extraordinary to think of some of these long-existing, almost establishment parties in Europe, like the Social Democrats in Germany and France. In France, they all but disappeared.
Yeah.
But we have our own, I don't know whether you could call it creative destruction, but
sure.
In effect, the Democratic Party is reshaping. You can see that the left is insurgent, the centrists are endangered, and the Republican Party has become Trump's party. And I think over time, it seems like there'll be less and less room for moderate Republicans, traditional Republicans. So what is behind this tectonic shift?
Well, first of all, what happens is for quite a long time, and with an accelerating trend, people all over the world, the large majority of people, according to hard data, do not believe that they are governed democratically. They do not believe in their parliaments, in their governments, in their political leaders, in their parties, and they despise politicians. That's universal. So the issue is that until now, let's say until 10 years ago, 8 years ago, we knew that, but all this did not translate into actual changes in the political systems. And so people just went about their lives. And then the 2008 financial crisis came with what we know, ultimately governments saved the banks and the financial institutions with our money. Plainly, blatantly, to some extent, was necessary to make things better than worse. But still, for many people, there was the shock they needed to start going into a different level of activity, not just being discontent, not just thinking what they were thinking, but acting. And that acting took first the form of a series of social movements, what we call in America the Occupy, but actually started in the Arab countries for different reasons, but were the same kind of movements on the internet and occupying squares, etc., etc., and then in Iceland, and then in Spain, and then all over Europe, and then all over Latin America. So this became from indignation to indignation movement, to outrage, what I call outrage movements. Then from there, filtered down to dissatisfaction with the political system. Now, many people would expect that that could be the beginning of true progressive politics. But things didn't turn out exactly like this. Happened in some countries, like Spain or Greece or Portugal. But in most of Europe, and certainly in the United States, was actually the anti-establishment right wing that took advantage of this. And Trump, and more than Trump, a number of strategies that were soon around him, like Bannon, etc., was very important, Bannon, as a key character, seized the opportunity to actually create an anti-establishment right-wing and even extreme right racist, sexist movement, which ultimately seized power in the United States. Remember, Trump destroyed the entire Republican establishment in the primaries. Many people thought it was a joke, and he just kept going. And the media made a huge mistake. Well, it's an understandable mistake, but they kept talking only about Trump. And in communication, we know that the most important thing is that the presence in the media, not if they say it's good, it's bad. What people see is this person centers all the debates, all the discussion, all the ideas, and then they immediately polarize for or against. And that's it. And everybody else disappears, and particularly the moderates disappear. And clearly is the dominant presence of Trump changed American politics. Yes, he lost, I mean, his party lost the last congressional elections, but by no means is sure that he's going to be defeated in his re-election campaign. So this is a critical thing. We have shifted dramatically in the entire world. Here in Europe, in Latin America, Brazil, it's very important what's happening with Bolsonaro. And if you look at the factors, at the people who mobilize and vote for these characters, etc., it's always the same. It's disaffected people supported by the economic elites of every country and connected globally, which in fact reproduces very much, although I'm not saying the same, reproduces the phenomenon of Nazism in the 1930s in the wake of the economic crisis, in which the working class of Germany mobilized support for Hitler, but of course finance supported by the industrialists. Is to some extent something going on.
So if this is a case of alienation versus engagement, alienation in politics, of course, in many ways is something that the elite exploit. America is the least participatory democracy of all.
Sure.
Barely 60%. That's a big deal if 60%.
Absolutely.
So let's think about it in those terms. I've always understood social democracy to be a simple contract where you vote for politicians who are stewards of your tax money and provide you with government services. In this country, of course, we don't have that transactional approach. We vote over guns and abortion and other social issues. So how do you reestablish engagement, and how much do you think alienation serves the interests of the powerful and the oligarchy, if you will?
Well, first of all, alienation serves whoever is in power in society. Because if you are alienated, you don't see the reality and you are ready to be manipulated. That's why listening to programs such as yours and this station is important, because there are some medication to treat political and social alienation. So informing yourself. I thought that we have internet, but the problem is that internet is so polluted from everything, and it's normal. Internet is us. Internet is the society as it is. And if we're alienated, internet is alienated. But anyway, you could find some more information in the internet, in social networks, in the media. So that's one way. And the other is really to exercise a critical reflection about what's going on. So I always start not with my opinion, but what's happening. You talk about social democracy. Really, there was no social democracy in America in any sense, but there was some elements in the 1960s and maybe 70s, Carter, in terms of some people who were doing exactly what you say without saying social democracy, because social democracy was too close to socialism, that, and to be a socialist in America used to be like eating human flesh. Mm-hmm. Now even Sanders decided that he can be socialist. And now, but in the countries, mainly in Europe, where social democracy was strong, was actually the backbone of the European Union and the backbone of democratic politics and the welfare state in Europe. And literally has disintegrated in almost everywhere, with the exception of Portugal and a little bit of Spain, and now Spain is coming back. And the reason is very simple. Social democracy stopped being social democracy and adopted neoliberal policies theorized and implemented under Blair as the third way. Well, the third way was a dead end because what happens when people have to choose between neoliberals on the right and neoliberals on the right, they prefer the original. And they go on the right. And that's literally the reason for country after country after country. So it's no more democracy. Not because I'm original from Spain, but I think Spain has shown how it's possible to turn the trend, because the Secretary General, of the very young man of the Spanish Socialist Party, who came 40 years old, Pedro Sánchez, who came to be Secretary General the first time that the grassroots could vote rather than just the bureaucracy of the party, he decided now to try to have an alliance with the left, with the people that were coming from the social movements, and to debunk the very corrupt popular party. And he was stopped by the historic leaders of the Spanish social democracy, Felipe González and others. And ultimately, he was ejected quite illegally from the leadership of the party. And Pedro Sánchez decided to counterattack, had a grassroots campaign, and in the few months later, in the Congress of the party, he took control of the party. And he completely changed the policies. And actually, he's facing now election in April. But he completely changed, and when it was clear social democratic policy, making alliance with the left, not with the right, and being uncompromising on pension, social rights, minimum wage, and most importantly, which social democracy was never before, he declared his party and his government feminist, explicitly feminist, and putting the fight for women at the top of the parameter. Well, this is not to talk about the Spain. This is to say that in 1 year after these policies, this party that was as destroyed as all the other social democratic party now is clearly going to win the next election in April, and has in fact split the right in three pieces and has recovered the hegemony of social democracy. So the formula is very simple. Social democrats can actually regain a certain level of influence in the world if they are social democrats. It's as simple as that. And by the way, in Italy now is starting the same thing. But in the United States, I still don't see seeds of that in the Democratic Party, which is again looking for the savior, looking for the person who is better or not in terms of the projections of the polls, and most important, who can raise more money.
Because
as long as money is the deciding factor in American politics, will be no social democracy and, in fact, no democracy.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Manuel Castells, a university professor and the Wallace Annenberg Chair of Communication Technology and Society at the University of Southern California, as well as a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and a fellow of St. John's College, Cambridge. And his latest book just out is Rupture, The Crisis of Liberal Democracy. So the opposite of what you're just telling us about Spain, of course, would be the paralysis in the UK over Brexit. And that leads to a broader question about what the real challenges in the world today are not between socialism and capitalism or whatever, communism versus capitalism. It seems to be whether or not democratic institutions can survive in what seems like an inexorable move towards kleptocracy and autocracy. And those are the simple challenges. And looking at that, I would suggest that Vladimir Putin is winning. I mean, it's extraordinary how well he's doing. He's about to, through people like Bannon, about to influence the May elections for the EU. If they get enough votes by supporting all of these far-right parties, they will have veto power. Already a very small investment via Arron Banks and his KGB or FSB wife, a former prostitute, by the way, that the FSB used to ensnare this so-called British magnate who was the biggest donor to Brexit. It's extraordinary how well he's doing. And of course, as Trump, now feeling emboldened, might well be able to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, make America even more divided and more weak. Nobody listens to Pompeo. Brand America is losing. Look what's happening to Boeing. So my sense is that this is an extraordinary moment where this guy in Russia, who has an economy that's going nowhere, that he's looting, is winning on the global stage. So please explain that to me. I'm not saying Putin's a genius, but and maybe we're just led by idiots, but something extraordinary is going on here.
Well, Ian, the one thing I would never say is that Trump is an idiot, or that Bannon is an idiot. I think most of the Democratic leaders are idiots, right. In the political sense, of course, not personal. They do not understand reality.
Right.
They continue to use the categories and the issue of many, many years ago.
Right.
My only hope, concretely speaking, is about women. Women showed in the last campaign in the United States that they can self-organize, they can be new leaders, new sources of mobilization. Frankly, it's not demagogic, it's not paternalistic. I think we have some hope of progressive politics in America and in the world is the rising consciousness of women. Because look, one of the common elements, my book would really analyze this, is the coincidence of many different factors in all these movements toward the right and toward the delegitimation of liberal democracy. And my argument is a very simple one, is in spite of a huge differences in context, in politics, in history, we observe the same type of phenomenon everywhere in the world. There is something going on. And therefore, in that sense, I think one of the key elements is reaction of men against the rights of women in every party, in Spain, in France, in to some extent in Brexit, certainly in the Trump movement, the reaction of the angry white male is clearly one of the key factors. Now, about Putin, he has is a good strategy, he's smart, and he is taking advantage of the extreme weakness of the legitimacy in liberal democracy, of the confusion, of the lack of the determined leadership, and the lack of values. I mean, people, we all believe in the values of democracy, but not in this particular type of democracy. As you said, which you described very well in your words, so I will not repeat. I would amplify the phenomenon. Putin is strong politically, internally, and externally. First, it's not true that Putin is an unpopular government. Another thing that we are doing is telling stories to ourselves. Is Russia a dictatorship? Is China a dictatorship? Yes. Of a different kind. They do elections in Russia. But the most important thing is that these two regimes, which are the most powerful after the United States in the world, they actually work. Work in which sense? They have restarted economic growth in Russia, substantial economic growth in China, 10% average in the last 20 years. And more or less, there is a certain satisfaction in the population around issues such as nationalism. Russia was humiliated after the transition. And what is sustaining Putin is patriotism. As Trump and his movement is about patriotism. So we are patriots against patriots. That's a very dangerous trend. Right. So first, Putin has a very strong legitimacy inside Russia. About 65% of people actively support and disclose in the elections what Putin is doing, basically on these two grounds, improvement of the economic situation vis-a-vis what was happening in the transition period, and nationalism. And even more so in China. And look, what we are seeing is politically, Russia has the initiative. And then technologically and economically, China is the superpower. Not militarily, because it's not their thing, and they have no interest in confronting military the United States when it's their main market and is also their main borrower. I mean, 20% of the U.S. Treasury bonds are in the hands of the Chinese banks, meaning the government. But these days, there's a tremendous battle, tectonic battle in technology, which will define the immediate future of societies, is about the 5G. The 5G is the network which right. completely transforms everything, the economy, society, etc., let's say is four times faster and three times more able to manage volume than our current 4G phones. We have 5G phones, but not 5G networks.
Right, we don't have the fiber.
And that's exactly. And the leader, clear leader, is Huawei,
right.
which is not a government company, but it's a Chinese company.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of stimulating American companies to actually compete, etc., etc., I observe that there is a shock in the American establishment, similar to 1957 with the Soviet Sputnik.
Sputnik, right.
The Chinese now are going to be laying out the most advanced network system in the world, and everybody ultimately has to use it. Let's kill it quickly rather than competing, stop it, and even arrest the daughter of the founder. Well, this is absolutely ridiculous. It's panic. It's this people, the elites in the West are disconcerted. And the UK, which is a very powerful and interesting and innovative country, is totally decomposed, not only Brexit or not Brexit, but which kind of Brexit, under which sauce we are going to be eaten or we eat. And we still don't know if it is going to remain an economic union but not a political union. It's just, they just go out completely if the parties are split, or the most likely, I believe, could be elections.
A do-over, right.
And that could be a chance for the Labour Party that has this position of let's vote again, which I think most people in Britain now are espousing.
Well, just in the last minute, given that what's just happened here indicates to me at least how clever the Republicans are, how much more they are focused on power, you've got this four-page memo from the Attorney General who auditioned for the job, and he's been able to basically hold down the Mueller report that everybody's been anticipating, put out his version of reality, which has become the one that the public accepts, and we don't even know that we'll ever see the full Mueller report. And it appears to me to be an extraordinary move on the part of the Republicans, just as the way they can stack the Supreme Court. They also, in this case, in effect, William Barr has rescued the Republican brand, which would have been really hurt if indeed they'd gone ahead with indicting Trump for obstruction of justice, which apparently was something that was seriously discussed. But Barr was able to put it all in a four-page letter, and everybody's now accepting that that's the reality. We haven't even seen the report yet.
Exactly.
So what's wrong with the side that I'm on, which is the opposite of the Republican side? What can you suggest they should do, apart from find a backbone and a narrative?
First of all, perception is reality. And the left continues to believe that having the right ideas, the right policies, the progressive causes, these ultimately prevail. Well, maybe in the next life, but certainly not in the short or medium term.
So in other words,
a huge movement, grassroots movement, led by the new young leaders that exist in the Democratic Party, to request and impose the full disclosure of the Mueller report. This concrete thing, which actually would have great consequences, even if there is nothing in the report.
Right.
But forcing to release the report and breaking through the maneuvering of the politicians, just that would start a new form of politics.
Right. So, in other words, progressives would rather be righteous than effective. And you're saying that these new young progressives indicate that they are out to be effective. They want to win.
Well, at least they want to stand up.
Stand up. There, that's that. Okay. Well, on that qualified note of optimism, I thank you very much for joining us here in the studio, Manuel Castells.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I may speak with Manuel Castells, who's a university professor and the Wallace Annenberg Chair of Communication Technology and Society at the University of Southern California, as well as Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and a fellow of St. John's College, Cambridge. And his latest book just out is Rupture, The Crisis of Liberal Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.